Adam Lane Smith, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You did such a great job last time. I thought I'd invite you back.
I hear that a lot. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's going
to be
a good conversation. You're so well versed in romantic relationships and psychology and all the things that you cover.
I've lived it.
You've lived it. Is that right? Let me ask you some. We'll start it off with. Are some people just not built for long-term relationships?
No, I think everybody is capable of them. I just don't think that everybody grows up in a way that makes them healthy for them. I think that a lot of people grow up in a way that makes it so that they're afraid of long-term connection, or that long-term connection sounds toxic or poisonous to them. Many of them don't get the chemicals they need in early childhood. Many of them have messaging that relationships are too painful. A lot of people with avoidant attachment style, they just don't have any benefit for being in long-term relationships either. So they have all the drawbacks and none of the joy. No one would do that.
And this all comes from their tough childhoods, their parents' relationships?
It's their childhood. Sometimes if they're born and they get put into the NICU for the first 3 weeks of life and they're in there screaming and they can't get comfort and people love them, but they don't know it. The brain can say, no one's going to come and help me. I'm alone. If it's daycare way too early for way too long, the cry it out method, abuse, trauma, neglect, all of these things create a constellation of feelings that the baby learns something's off and nobody's going to help me. So then they have to figure out what to do about that.
Even in the first 3 weeks of life?
First 3 weeks of life.
Wow, you'd think a little baby that young wouldn't be aware of anything.
But the brain's incredible. It's forming a whole pattern recognition even during that time. And then it begins testing it. And if the parents are overly stressed, they're exhausted, they don't have much time, it all goes into that ecosystem. But now it's colored by people don't have time for me. I was scared and no one came to help me. Let's see what happens next. So it forms this bias that just begins to snowball.
Wow. Do you believe some people are addicted to chaos rather than love?
Yes. There's people with something called disorganized attachment style, what we call loud disorganized, which is outward, outgoing, and they are very overwhelmed by their emotions. They have a very weak prefrontal cortex, so it doesn't filter their emotions correctly. It doesn't form properly in childhood. And their emotions are their leverage point for having control in the world. So if they can make you feel something, then they can play off that feeling you have and create safety. It's not a personality disorder. That's a whole other thing. This is, if I don't feel safe, I use emotions, mine and yours, to get leverage points to reach safety. But they'll never feel safe, either alone or with other people. There's two different flavors of terror there. So they have to pick which one is less terrifying to me right now. I'll run for that one. Yes, that's chaos and they're addicted to it, but it's a safety metric more than anything.
Hmm. And a lot of your work is focused around attachment styles.
Yep, and fixing them to become secure. I want to say that very clearly because a lot of people, they take their attachment style and they say, this is me. I'm doomed forever. I will always be this thing. I will always have this problem. I will never be good enough. And the goal is to fix it and to become healthy and secure so that you can be at peace.
Oh, really?
That's our target.
So some people, you know, some people are capable of changing their childhood style that was built in.
All people are capable of it. All people are. It's just that most people, they don't know that it's possible. They think that this is how they are supposed to feel, or they think something's wrong with them, or they think no one else will ever love them. So then they don't learn the skills they need and then use them with the right people to have the right experiences. But then our brain can reshape. I was talking to Dr. Caroline Leaf recently. She's brilliant. But her team proved that in 2 months, you can change your brain pathways through just activity and connection with other human beings. Even just 2 months can remap parts of your brain. So it's proven, but most people are in so much despair that they don't do the things that would give them new experiences that would reshape their brain. So then they have 80 years of life experience having the same experiences that just keeps their brain the same. That's the problem. But everyone can change.
Why do people often feel the strongest attraction to people who hurt them the most?
Here's what I'll say. It's a hard question because I try to be gentle with people when I say this, but I won't be as gentle. I'll just be blunt. We only know how to survive in circumstances that we have skills for. And if we grow up in circumstances where people treated us poorly, we think that's all that we will ever have. And so we are skilled to survive where people treat us poorly. If someone comes along and treats us well, our system is afraid because we don't know what to do with people who treat us well, and we're afraid we won't survive. We don't know how to survive when people treat us kindly. And even worse, we wonder what's hidden behind that kindness. Either they are doing something that's going to hurt us, they're going to betray us, and this is a mask, or they will realize we don't deserve that kindness and they'll abandon us and we'll get even more hurt. It's hopeless with kind people. At least with hurtful people, we can survive. And the brain doesn't care about you being happy. The brain cares about you surviving. That's a problem.
How much of adult romantic attraction is basically unresolved childhood attachments?
65% of adults. 65%. No, that's what the research says. Wow. About 35%, and that's an optimistic number, about 35% of American adults have secure attachment where it's connecting to the human. It's connecting human to human. And our relationship is something we build together that nurtures us and cares for us. So we build a relationship that's sustainable and it lasts. So if I take care of you, I'm taking care of myself. It's a concrete relationship. 65% of people are across that binary into insecure attachment, where the relationships is just the feelings between us at any given moment. So if we have a great relationship for 10 years, and then we have a bad day where you don't like me today, we have a bad relationship right now on the spot, and it's almost dead, and I'm in danger. It's all the feelings between us. That's 65% of adults hyper-focusing on the relationship feelings instead of the actual connection.
Hmm. Can someone with severe attachment trauma actually have a stable relationship without years of therapy?
Yes, absolutely. Really? Yeah, therapy
without,
does.
Without the therapy?
Yes. Therapy, unfortunately, doesn't usually work for attachment. Unfortunately, I wish it did. Therapy is supposed to come in and work on specific disorders. That's what it was always built for. But it has expanded now to be your subscription friend, your priest, your mentor, your dad, your mom, your everything. And so you just pay the subscription and stay in it for the rest of your life. Talk therapy is very not effective for attachment in particular, specifically because insight works on the prefrontal cortex, which immediately goes offline about 5 times faster than the limbic system, which activates the moment your partner doesn't text you back. So all that training you did in therapy doesn't usually translate to an actual better relationship. Instead, we have to recalibrate the nervous system through body work, usually, and then learn different experience skills so you can have the skills you need to craft those experiences. Then you need to have experiences with human beings outside, friends, family, other people. That's how you have to remap. I'm not saying therapy is useless. I was a therapist myself for many years, but for attachment, it doesn't really work.
Why do some people sabotage relationships once they start feeling safe?
I want you to imagine for a moment, and maybe you can imagine this, and many people can. Imagine for a moment that the only joyful moments in your childhood were just the calm before the worst, most painful storms you ever knew. That the calm moments were you calmed down and relaxed just enough for somebody to betray you or blindside you or hurt you or abuse you. So the calm moments themselves become dangerous because you are at rest and you're not ready for the next thing to happen. And then when you're an adult and someone hugs you and they love you and they say, I will never leave you, and part of you begins to soften and let go, you remember those 100 times or 1,000 times in childhood that it led to disaster, and your system amps up through the roof and says, I'm going to be destroyed this time because I'm letting go and you're going to hurt me, or I'm going to hurt us, one or the other. So they amp up and they say, I can't do this and I will do anything but that. So they sabotage the relationship and they start a fight with you over milk, shoes, sex, money, anything. Anything to just get away from that moment of impending disaster. That's why people sabotage.
Wow. Do people confuse intensity with love?
Yes, absolutely. And intensity is there as a coping mechanism because you have to run away from the pain you're feeling. Intensity is not really the goal. We can build to steady, sustainable intensity over time, but that's 4, 5, 6 months into a relationship at least. And then you do it maybe once or twice a month as a sustainable couple. Intensity is not the target, and especially not within the first 4 or 5 months of a relationship. You need to build slowly over time. That's what you need.
What's the most common relationship dynamic you see today that people don't recognize?
Absolutely, hands down, it would be anxiously attached partners who don't believe they are worthy of love and who try to fawn and please other people to make them happy with no boundaries whatsoever. And they do 10 nice things for you, hoping you'll do one nice thing for them. And they're terrified of abandonment or even the hint of abandonment. Connecting to people who are avoidantly attached, who don't believe anyone else will ever be honest or loyal to them ever. So they don't want any strings attached or expectations. And they want the free exchange of dopamine back and forth. And they need to be able to walk at a moment's notice. And they value space and independence. And these two people get together, and it's incredible for the first 90 days. And then it begins to fall apart. The avoidant person starts to say, wow, I need a little space. But they don't say it, because other people will turn on them if they say it. So they start withdrawing quietly. And the anxious person says, oh, no, they're hypervigilant. You're withdrawing from me, and that means I did something wrong, and you're abandoning me. I need to crank it up through the roof and cling to you as hard as possible. So it creates this horrible push-pull, run-and-chase dynamic for the next 4 months until you hit 7 months. Then the avoidant person, their novelty dopamine is gone at 7 months, gone. They have not bonded through oxytocin or vasopressin, the hormones we need, so they have no connection and no pleasure, right as the anxious person is starting to talk about marriage and kids and buying a house together, and it blows up in both of their faces again and again and again. Very common.
There's 100,000 people watching this going, is this guy Kreskin?
100%. Everyone that talks to me says, have you been watching me in my home? Like, that's most relationships today. Like I said, about 65% of dating people right now.
Are men or women more likely to be emotionally avoidant?
This is a great question. The research in the old days, back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Men have the reputation as being avoidant.
Yes, exactly. Men were more avoidant then, seemingly. Survival, lone wolf, suspicious, just buckle down and work myself to death and don't let anyone in. And that's the older generations. And women were more likely to be anxious, people-pleasing, fawning, quiet, and then assuming they're not good enough, low self-esteem. I was talking to my mentor, Dr. Robert Glover. He literally wrote the book on anxious men and nice guy syndrome. And he and I have talked, and anecdotally, what we've seen, it seems like the world is shifting the opposite, where there's so many young men in Gen Z today who are raised by single moms with almost no men available. So these young men are trying to just endlessly please women, and they're turning more anxious. And women are being raised by angry, stressed out, traumatized women, multiple generations. Don't ever trust men. They'll betray you. And women are turning more avoidant. So it does seem to be going the opposite of what it was previously.
What personality type tends to end up in the most destructive relationships?
Personality type or attachment style?
Either one.
Either one. That's a great question. I'll go with both. So there is a small, very small subset that I've pulled out that the field of attachment theory and psychology as a whole completely ignored. This group of women especially was absolutely invisible, and it's because they wanted to be. It's what called quiet disorganized. They have anxious tendencies of, I don't want to be abandoned, I'm not good enough, and avoidant tendencies of, I will never let anyone in because they'll hurt me. They were traumatized in childhood, but instead of going big and blowing up and control, they went inward and collapsed and became servants of everyone around them to be as invisible as possible. They're the only group with a freeze response where they lock down and shut down, but their face goes blank, so people assume they don't care. They call them an ice princess. They say all kinds of unkind things, but they're some of the sweetest people on the planet. These women have no boundaries. But everyone else assumes they're cold and aloof and distant. So when they walk up and say and try to talk to them and connect with them, those women just freeze solid and push back like this. And they go, oh, you're not interested. You're too good for me. And they leave. Except the most hurtful, chaotic, intrusive, demanding partners who bludgeon in, shove through, and then say, oh, you're frozen. Well, good. What can I loot from this place? And they say, oh, do you have a boyfriend? No. Well, you do now. And they take over her life. And she goes, okay, I guess I'm going to take care of you for the rest of your life. So they just take on the most damaging, hurtful partners you can imagine. And they are faithful and monogamous to them without even a word of complaint for 20, 30 plus years. Sometimes until that man dies or he cheats on her 10, 15 times. And she finally says, okay, maybe that's a little too much. Or he leaves her for somebody else. She is faithful to death at this point. And those women, I work with them, most of them come to me when they're 65 and say, you know, I guess I haven't really been happy, and I don't know if happiness is possible. It's never occurred to them that there could be anything but just endless pain and invisibility and self-abandonment. It is one of the saddest things I've ever seen, honestly. Still can be fixed, but it's one of the saddest things that's out there.
And happiness is possible.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. I work with them all the time. And many of them have good people in their lives that they've never connected to. And those people assumed she was just disinterested because she was frozen and she didn't want to intrude on them and say, hey, I'd love to spend time with you. Can we do that? So she never has. And they assumed she didn't want to. So when she starts to actually open up and ask them, hey, would you like to spend time with me? I just thought you didn't like me. Yes, I'd love to. And they connect, and it's this joyful moment of actually feeling loved. Yes, I think anybody can fix their attachment, even that cycle.
But what subtle signs tell you a couple is actually healthy?
A couple's happy? Healthy? That's a good one. It's not even arguing. It's not even passion or intensity. It's not even chaos necessarily. It's repair. Can they, after they have a disruption or a breach of any kind, can they come back, calm down their nervous systems and come back and both of them say, I care about you way more than I care about whatever we just argued about. I'm going to manage myself differently and I'm going to change so I don't do that again. I don't want to spark at you that hard. Here's what I should have said. And by the way, now that that's resolved, are we okay? Do you need anything from me so that you feel whole again and you don't walk on eggshells? That's repair. And that's a skill that's been lost, unfortunately, for the last 100 years for most families here in the West. But if a couple can repair, they can trend in the right direction, even if they're a little chaotic at the start.
That's beautiful. What behavior immediately tells you a relationship won't survive?
Contempt. The Gottmans were very clear in their research that contempt is the number one predictor of divorce. It's one person looking at the other and saying, I'm better than you. Your feelings don't matter. In fact, I laugh at them. I laugh at you. Anything you say is worthless to me. I'm the only one that matters in this relationship. You are too stupid for me to care about you. Contempt tells me it's just about over.
And both men and women will do that.
Both men and women. And if both of them are doing it, it is absolutely over. I tell that couple, guys, this is not workable. This is an impasse. If you guys are going to do this, we're done. There is no hope here. That's the one thing that will not be workable.
So you need the respect for your partner.
You need to treat them like a human being with dignity. If you can't do that, the relationship's not functional.
Wow. Has dating culture made attachment problems worse?
It's a little bit of the chicken and the egg. Dating problems got worse because of attachment issues. Back in 1995, 65% of people found a partner through family and friends, 12% through what we call then computer dating. Now it's the opposite, 12% through family and friends and 65% through computer dating and apps. But I think that's because most people, 88% of people don't have family friend networks anymore. I don't think they're less useful. That's still where we find good partners. People don't have family friends. So now it's a bunch of people getting on apps and saying, I hope I find a stranger who won't hurt me. And that's what dating culture is now. And then they get hurt and hurt and hurt and hurt. And they raise kids who are hurt and hurt and hurt and only see dysfunction. Gen Z, they've grown up in the ashes of a civilization that's already gone. Our machines are still running. And so the reason we still think that it's okay, but it's not. They're living in rubble and they're trying to reconnect in disaster. They've never seen a functioning relationship before, so they don't know how to build one.
Are dating apps training people to treat partners as disposable?
I think it was already there. The programming was there. But certainly now when we are lacking oxytocin and vasopressin bonding hormones that are crucial for humans, when we lack those hormones, when our nervous system is constantly in sympathetic fight or flight mode, so we're scared and we're worried and we don't produce serotonin to be content, when we don't have oxytocin and belonging with humans, then we don't produce GABA, so our cortisol is unregulated, then all we have to play with is cortisol and dopamine. So I need to decrease my cortisol or suppress it by binging dopamine. Those are the only two things I have. And dating apps are built for that. You go on there and you flip and swipe and you get a dopamine hit every time you swipe either direction. You get a dopamine hit. And dopamine will wear out in 5 to 7 months in a relationship if it even takes that long anymore. So you're really competing endlessly with dopamine binging on the apps, not even to mention pornography, which we have found. If a person has sex, they have, let's say, 1 unit of dopamine. If a person snorts cocaine, they have 3 units of dopamine. And if they look at professionally produced pornography, they have 21 units of dopamine for each hit. Pornography and dating apps have obliterated dating if if we are focusing on dopamine, which many people are.
How big a problem is pornography in modern relationships?
I don't think it could be overstated, no matter how big of a problem we say it is. It is a problem and a symptom at the same time. It's both. Really, the fix for it is the same fix as fixing attachment, which is to build the bonding hormones of oxytocin and vasopressin, to build the conditions under which you work with vasopressin to work as a team and solve problems. Very addictive. It starts overcoming that dopamine obsession and the oxytocin of belonging and loving and intimacy, real emotional, mental intimacy together. If you can build those together, then your cortisol levels plunge, and then dopamine's just a little bit of a spice that gets added, so it's much less attractive. That cuts down on, yes, cocaine addiction and drug addiction. It cuts down on a lot of other addictions as well, because you don't need them to cope with the pain anymore. But also porn addiction actually starts to disintegrate. When I work with my couples where the man has a porn addiction, we have to get oxytocin and vasopressin going, and then suddenly he's not interested in the porn anymore. It's not even that he's built a system to protect against it. He's just less interested. It's amazing.
And that works.
It usually works, yes. Usually you do need a system on top of that for the weak times when you are stressed.
To my way of thinking, I would just say, just stop it.
Just stop it. Just stop. Yes. And many people will say that. But if you have nothing else, you will be tempted at least to cycle back into it. And the temptations.
No, you have to find an actual live human being.
Yes, that's correct. You have to find humans, but human intimacy with friendship and family, you need an ecosystem. We're hunter-gatherers. Our brains are built for 20,000 years ago in the forest and the caves and tribal structures where you're around humans who are incentivized to work with you 24/7. You are always in the mix, bonded with them. It's not utopia, but it is incentivized to be harmonious as much as possible. So you work together with love, acceptance, and teamwork, and our systems are meant for that. Now we live in modern day box world where you are in a box 24/7. The box just changes and changes locations and colors, but you're alone in that box with this little nightmare rectangle that we stare into all the time, which is pumping more dopamine into our brain. We are endlessly dopamine binging in the worst possible environment that is nothing like where we came from.
With men becoming a little more feminized in modern days and women like now becoming not more masculine, but maybe more just they're the breadwinners very often, and they're taking over some of the roles that men used to have.
Yeah.
Are men and women becoming more emotionally incompatible?
If we don't fix the attachment, yes. I've seen a lot of women on TikTok, Instagram, a lot of the women I talk to, they say, I'm tired of being in my masculine. I can't do this anymore. And we know that when a woman's in that, what we would call a masculine mode or survival mode, she's in a survival mode. We know that it destroys her estrogen and progesterone. We know it destroys her fertility. We know it destroys her immune system. It trades the short-term survival for long-term survival. We know that that leads to chronic pain and inflammation running throughout her entire body. We know that her sleep quality degrades very badly, so she has a lot of problems there. She can't produce serotonin, so she's more prone to anxiety and depression. We know that her risks of cancer, especially reproductive cancers, heart attack, stroke, insulin issues, all of that goes up dramatically. Women can fulfill masculine roles, but it kills them, and it's horrible agony the entire time it's killing them. That's why they're getting resentful and hurt, especially because men should be stepping in and fulfilling that role. Now, it's not that, again, that women can't, or to put them on a velvet pillow, women have a separate role that only they can fulfill in that feminine role, which is to bring oxytocin and intimacy and closeness and warmth and rejuvenation to those around them so that they can do that. And it's not about not working or not having a career or being in the home. It's about the way you live, the being that you are, and how you show up in every environment you enter. It's very different. If you're in a survival state as a woman, you can't be in this overflowing state as a woman. And women know this. So many of them are seeking a masculine partner, and men do not know how to be masculine anymore. That's an art that largely has been lost for most men.
Is that because of not having father figures in their lives, or is it because of the environment and the hormones and the meat and the
estrogen
and the plastic and whatever.
It's everything, but it's also this. If you tell multiple generations of young men that it's no longer fashionable to be masculine and that women won't want you and women only want feminine men with tight jeans who are overly sensitive, who cry at the drop of a hat, and you have to just play along and make them happy. And then you're raised by angry, tired mothers, grandmothers, and aunts who put you down for being a man and punish you for the other men in their lives who hurt them. If you are just raising men in this culture that says masculine is evil, you're not going to get masculine men who are ready to step forward and lead. You're going to get men waiting for women to lead, which is exactly what's killing women and men.
Yeah. Do we unconsciously recreate the emotional environment of our childhoods?
Yes, we have to. It's all that we know. The brain is trying to keep us alive. It's not trying to keep us happy.
It's all we know.
That's all we know. So if you take a man and raise him in the jungle, and then you take him to New York City and give him $10 million, he's going to try to recreate a jungle or go back to the jungle because he can't survive in New York City. He'll try, and the fun will be there and some dopamine will be there, but eventually his life overwhelms him and he can't do it and he'll flee back. Again and again, we see this pattern. Humans gravitate toward what they know.
And you see couples that fight constantly and still feel unable to separate.
Yes.
What's that all about?
It's called a cortisol association. Your heart still loves them. You love that person, but your brain has tagged them as an enemy. It says, when you're around, my problems get worse. I can't fix things because of you, but I love you and I still have a bond to you. I don't know what to do about it. And both of them have a cortisol association against each other. Usually they go through three or four different couples therapists. They end up in my door, but that's usually what we have to start in. Then we have to stop. We have to do what's called stop the bleed. First, we have to teach those women and those men how to not hurt each other anymore. At least stop the hurt. At least minimize the hurt and the friction. That doesn't even mean agreeing with each other or liking each other. When therapists say go on couples dates, what they're doing is flooding with oxytocin. That's the wrong thing to do. You don't go on couples dates and increase the intimacy because that just increases the hurt next time, which is exactly what gets them to that deep pit. You have to stop the cortisol. Then you have to increase vasopressin by solving problems together ruthlessly as a team, building it like a business. You have to work on the relationship like a business. And then once the bleed is done and your brain starts to say, okay, we're not best friends, but we can solve problems together. I like you. Now you start the intimacy again. Now you start the dates. Now you start the connection. Then your brain says, oh yeah, I do like you. Okay, I remember that now. But it has to be that sequence. Decrease the cortisol, increase the vasopressin, increase the oxytocin. Oxytocin first is death. That's the divorce cycle right there.
Talk to me about jealousy. Is it something that comes from attachment style and just becomes out of control, or...
I'm always tempted to say everything is attachment related, of course, but jealousy in particular is a feeling that I'm not safe. I'm not safe. You're going to leave me, or I'm not going to get my needs met. Sibling rivalry in families where they're not connected fully and the parents don't have time and attention and resources for the kids, especially the emotional connection, emotional resources. Sibling rivalry gets worse because it's, I won't have enough, so you can't be my ally. You are my opponent. I have to make sure I get enough. Sibling rivalry gets worse in those disconnected families. Same thing happens when we're in a couple. I need attention. I need love. I need care. I need you to not walk away. And you're spending so much time on your best friend, not me. My needs aren't met, and you're spending it over there with them instead. What about me? My needs, my resources, and my safety. That's where jealousy comes from. If you can establish abundance instead of scarcity in the relationship, if you can establish real intimacy and real attachment and connection and safety, and if you can get needs open and explicit and on the table and negotiate them peacefully like a good relationship should, then jealousy disappears. There need be no cause for jealousy at that point.
Have you seen patients? You see patients, correct?
I see clients, correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you seen a patient who has changed from being anxious and jealous and insane to calming down? And
yes. Oh, yes. This is a good one. So I have a lot of male clients come in with what's called retroactive jealousy, where they don't have their girlfriend loves them. She's adoring them, or his wife, whoever it is. She loves and adores him. And many of them have only had one boyfriend previously, not 50, one. She slept with one person before him, and it was a long-term monogamous relationship. It broke up. She has no attraction to that guy anymore and does not speak to him, has blocked him, no connection. And all that man can think about day and night is how she must want that other man, and he got the best of her, and now I'm not good enough. I never will be. She must want new things. She wants to explore. She wants to have fun. retroactive jealousy. And she is viciously against it, continuously trying to reaffirm to him, but he's ruining the relationship. I see that quite often. Have you met a man like that before?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Retroactive jealousy. Usually what that means is he doesn't think he's ever going to be able to take care of somebody else and give their needs because he doesn't think he's good enough. Number two, he thinks other people will never be satisfied even if he gave his best effort. So it's both him and them who's the problem. And then number three, he is absolutely sure that they are not honest to him, that person. Whether they're lying to themselves or to him, they're lying to somebody. This can't possibly be this way. I'm not safe. Back to that disorganized style we talked about earlier, the loud disorganized, he's ripping the relationship apart with the best partner he'll ever meet. Yes, I've seen that a lot.
What's the hardest relationship pattern for someone to change?
That's still changeable?
That's still changeable, yeah. Or isn't changeable.
Or isn't changeable. Is not changeable is definitely any relationship structure where two people have contempt for each other. Absolute, hands down. Contempt is absolute, almost unfixable. And I tell couples, this is not fixable for this reason. And sometimes they that shock is a slap to the face and they finally wake up and they stop having contempt for each other. They choose humility and kindness. Sometimes. So I tell them that bluntly. Another one would be if they have gone full personality disorder, where the attachment issue has overgrown into the fullness of who they are, and it's now subsumed them completely. And it's very hard to come back from a personality disorder. I don't think it's impossible. I know it is possible, but it takes such absolute ego death to do that. That would be another one. Still possible, but very difficult. A third, then I would say, from those two absolute extremes, would definitely be the loud, disorganized attachment style, a relationship where that's present. Just because love feels dangerous, fighting feels dangerous, screaming and yelling feels normal, and anytime their partner does things right, they get worse. So the good things that work for everybody else make someone with loud disorganized so much worse because love and safety feels like a trap. Helping them manage their nervous system, knowing they'll endlessly sabotage themselves until they reach a certain threshold, that's probably the hardest. It needs a lot of help and a lot of oversight.
Can someone with a long history of destructive relationships truly reset their attachment style?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. I think one of the most extreme cases I ever had was a wonderful woman. She came to me. She was 78 years old. She was terminally ill. She had 1 year to live. The doctors gave her. She actually had about 1 year and 1 month, we found out, as she passed away. But she came to me and we started working together for 1 year, and she had horrible, horrible history of abuse in her life. People had treated her like a subhuman. It was terrible. It was heartbreaking. She had three daughters. And she told me before she passed, I could tell this story. I'll protect privacy anyway, but she told me I could. She had three daughters who all were in abusive relationships as well because it was all they knew growing up. Her whole family was in it. She had granddaughters, grandsons, most of them using drugs, most of them dropping out of school, really broken family system. And she said, Adam, I've ruined everything and I'm going to die. And all I can do is sit here and watch my family fall apart for the next year. She worked hard. Very hard. She talked with her daughters. She talked with her friends. She rebuilt those relationships. It made all the difference. By the time she did pass, her daughters were actually out of abusive relationships. They were connected to each other. They were supporting each other. Her grandkids were getting off drugs. Her grandkids were growing. They were starting to go into schools and learn trades and actual practical trades. She had a great grandchild who was born in that last year, and she got to hold that child before she passed. Whole family system started changing. Now, she hauled butt every day. She didn't go one day without doing relationship work. It was a lot. I won't say it was easy, but she changed everything. So, yes, I know even a lifetime like that with 1 year to live, with the clock running out, even that, you can still do the work.
It takes a lot of courage.
So much courage. She had incentive, though. This was her legacy. This was everything. I have so much respect for that woman.
What small behaviors signal that someone is capable of growth like that?
Being unhappy. Honestly, you have to be so unhappy that your brain says, this can't be the right answer. Because your brain growing up says, no, this is the only answer. Pleasing other people is my only answer. Avoiding people is my only answer. Causing chaos is my only answer. When you get in enough pain where you stop and say, there's got to be something else. There's got to be something else. That is the one moment that everything can begin to change. But until someone questions it, it's almost impossible to help them. That's one reason I love your program, is you teach everybody that there's always a better way. Every episode you do, there's always a better way for whatever it is they're facing. Mm-hmm. That's why I think they love this show.
Yeah, I think knowledge is power. And if you don't have the tools or the knowledge to figure out how to solve a problem, you're just going to repeat it over and over.
Even possibility is an amazing thing.
Yeah, hope is a great...
You teach so much hope. That's what this show's about, is hope and possibility. That's what really helps people wake up and start making changes. Anything before that, there's no hope.
What advice would you give someone who feels like they always choose the wrong partner?
That's a good one. If you always choose the wrong partner, it's probably because you don't have a long-term goal that is more important than feelings. Probably your feelings and how they lead you to safety is more important than any other goal in your life. So you're making short-term decisions based on feelings and safety. And that's a hard thing to break, to tell someone to stop feeling safe. That's a very hard thing to do. So finding people who make you feel safe with their character, friends and family, if you can, pseudo family, if you have to, anyone around you, and building that network so that you are safe. And now you can make decisions based on what your values are and what you desire to build. Then you can start finding a different partner, but it's got to be a long-term plan.
What does genuine emotional security actually look like in a partner?
Genuine emotional security looks like, if you're my partner and I have a fear or a worry or a concern or I'm guessing something, I can take a breath and I can say, you know what? He's always had me in the back. He's always had my back every time. He's always had me every time. I'm going to go talk to him. So I come and I talk to you and I say, look, and I give you context. I'm really scared right now. I'm scared to even do this. So please be patient with me. I'm going to say the wrong words first, and then I'm going to have to fine tune them. So if I hurt your feelings, I'm sorry. Please don't jump on me. Here's a concern or a worry or a confusion I have in our relationship, and I'm not sure what to do about it, but I'd like us to find a way to fix it. Okay, let me say that better a second time. Here's what I'm thinking now that I've said it out loud. Here's what I'm actually afraid of. What are you seeing from your side? And can we fix this together? And it would be you sitting there going, Adam, I'm a little surprised that you're afraid to bring this to me. But I hear you. I hear you. Yeah, okay. You said it weird the first time, but I'll take the second time. That works. You know, here's what I'm seeing from my side. And I'm glad to hear your side. Here's what I think we could do to fix it. Does that work for you? Can we give it a shot and try it for a week? That would be real emotional security. You don't have to be perfect. You could sit there and be confused, but you ask me questions and you learn and you just give me a place to fumble around and be honest. And then we build it together. It's clarity. It's explicitness. It's two people just trying, even if they're clumsy while they do it. That's emotional security.
What mistake do you see intelligent, self-aware people make repeatedly in love?
Intelligent, self-aware people. I see them relying on their prefrontal cortex, their thinking, their logic, and that's gone. That takes about 300 to 500 milliseconds to have a thought. But your limbic system takes over in 100 milliseconds, a tenth of a second. Faster than that, faster than I can snap. And it reroutes all of the energy away from your logical executive self, where you make great decisions, into fight, flight, fawn, and freeze. I will survive by making people happy, by fighting, by running, or by freezing solid and waiting for the damage to be done. And it's faster than you can possibly think, which is why the prefrontal cortex is not the way to go. First, managing your nervous system through your body. You have to use your body. The smartest people I know forget that their body is there and they try to use their brain instead. That is the worst thing you can do. Body first, interrupt the pattern, speak differently. Regulate, then communicate, in that order.
What do most people misunderstand about what healthy love actually feels like?
Ooh. They think healthy love is supposed to be euphoria all the time, that it's supposed to be some magical drug that rivals heroin. They think that it's supposed to be the most incredible feeling forever, that it will never have disagreements or confusion or grumpiness or bad days. And they think that if they have even the smallest problem, that it must mean that they're not a good compatible match or that they're failing somehow. And I tell people, conflict is the only place you grow trust. So healthy, secure people have a lot of conflict. The difference is their conflict doesn't turn into combat. It turns into cooperation. Conflict is just two questions. Number one, do our goals align or are our goals a little bit off? And number two, if our goals are a little bit off, do we have to fight about it or can we work this out together peacefully? If you can actually do that at the beginning of a conversation with your partner or your friend or your mom or whoever, you can actually cooperate during that conflict. And then you build intimacy and trust and safety. You build all those bonding hormones we talked about. The problem that most people have is they don't talk about their goals or their desires or anything. They just start launching into combat, or they just assume combat's coming, so they just fall down to the ground and try to please the other person.
For those that are trying to find love, what are the, I mean, you need to be, you can't be risk averse.
No, you can't.
You can't be, you need courage.
Yeah.
You almost need to be reckless a little bit. And then you kind of come to your senses and you stabilize everything.
Mm.
It seems like those skills are lost on some people.
When your nervous system is already so utterly alone and says, I'm alone, I'm in danger, no one will ever help me, I'm going to get hurt, I'm going to get attacked, every moment is life and death, every social interaction is the last experience I'll ever have, no one is ever going to help me, then you walk into everything terrified out of your mind, trying to manage yourself or manage the other person. And that's most people on dates, that's most people in the grocery store, that's most people with their friends, that's most people just hanging out at a birthday party. They're just utterly terrified, existentially. Yes. If we can get some safety in our friend networks and our community first, we have to build that before we focus on a romantic partner, really. If you can get your community, friends, people that love you, that care about you, that you can be honest with, the stakes are a lot lower there. It's not life and death, like I will be rejected by a partner. And then if you can go out in the world and go dating more appropriately, you can start talking about what you want long term. Instead of saying, okay, you want to just see where this goes for 8 years with no label? I guess I can do that. It's, no, you know what? I only want a committed relationship. We don't have to get married tomorrow, but that's all I want. Are you on that path too? Is it something you actually like crave and you're excited about, a committed relationship? Can we build toward that over the next couple of weeks and months as we learn about each other and then have explicit conversations about a label and then moving in, getting engaged or married or having kids if that's what we want to do? Are we aligned on what we want? Because I'm excited about it. Are you excited too? If you can have that excitement and that clarity and that explicitness, that's how you date properly. That's how you find someone that actually is going to like you, not somebody that's just there for the feelings.
The transactional nature of relationships is a touchy topic.
Yeah.
And sometimes I see it as you have to accept that things will be transactional, but you have to almost not ever speak about it and just be that, play that role in your partner's life without saying, hey, I'm giving you money for this, or I'm giving you sex for that, that support or whatever. And it's like, it's almost like you need to be an artist in terms of how not to speak about certain things.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, my friend Dr. Orion Terrabin is amazing at this. He says every relationship is transactional. And I do agree with him. We all have to have a reason to do things. But where he and I differ a little bit is the reasons. I look at attachment. When we have proper attachment, a mother and a child, this is interestingly still a transactional relationship. The mother has a reason to care for her child, but it's not a true transaction in the way without sentiment that my friend Dr. Orion would maybe say. The mother is flooded at the moment of birth with an overwhelming amount of oxytocin that gives her a sense of desire and belonging and fulfillment for this child. She's flooded with GABA, which suppresses her cortisol. She's pushed into her parasympathetic rest and digest nervous system. She's flooded with serotonin. She is bonded to this child intimately. So whatever good she does for this child also is good for her. We share a relationship where my giving to you fulfills me. So it's not that she's being selfish and caring for her child. She's not. But she's incentivized to maintain bio loyalty with this child. So she will pour herself into that child for all of her life because it biologically feels good. She's also a reasoning human being who actually loves her child. We can't forget the role of actual bio loyalty and love together. Those are two amazing things that when we leave them out of transactions, we become merciless sociopathic robots. And that's not the proper equation. Oxytocin, vasopressin, GABA, serotonin, and yeah, the magic of dopamine. All of that creates incentivized bio-loyalty. All of it does. That's what makes us love each other and want to give to the people we love.
You see a lot of couples, obviously. Are there couples that you've seen that, and you've seen them transform, and that are there couples that stand out in your in your memory of someone who really kind of turned the corner?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. What do you want to know?
Can you share a story or two?
Oh, absolutely. I had one couple come to me that had been together for 30 years, and she had been emotionally starved the entire time, quiet, shut down, invisible, quite disorganized. And he was heavily avoidant the entire time. So she just settled in, raised the kids, and assumed he would never give her an ounce of emotional intimacy. So she didn't complain. She just served faithfully for 30 years in their marriage, emotionally starving. And he, avoidant, was also emotionally starving, and had five short-term affairs during the course of their marriage. That was discovered at year 30, shortly after their 30th wedding anniversary. Now, they had successfully raised kids together. He was a genius in business. He was amazing financially. Everyone thought he was this paragon of virtue. And then, boom, overnight, he was this schmuck who had cheated on his wife. Everyone was looking at him differently. He hated himself. He called himself the perpetrator in the relationship. His level of self-view was so rock bottom. And his wife said, I've never felt more betrayed. It's not even the affairs. It's that I was starving for 30 years and thought I was serving a good man. The hardest part of my work with them was convincing them he was a good man. He was stupid. He did stupid things. He was ignorant. That's what I should say. The problem with avoidant men is that their oxytocin receptors are blocked from childhood for high levels of cortisol, so they never get emotional intimacy with even their own parents or their family or their caregivers. They've never felt the joy of closeness. All they've ever felt in relationships is the liability aspects and the pain. Their vasopressin is gone because they never solve problems with other human beings. Vasopressin is the molecule in mammals that actually helps us feel monogamous desire and fulfillment. It says, you are mine and I am yours and we win together. So he wasn't bonded to her at all, and he had no concept of emotional closeness. He had no GABA, so his cortisol was unregulated through his body, which was leading to all kinds of medical issues for him. All he had left was dopamine. Endless dopamine, which he denied himself as long as he could in his eyes, until he reached a massive stressful point at work and he had no connection to his wife or kids. They were off on their own. His wife didn't seem to want him because she left him alone because he didn't seem to want her. And he could justify having a short-term one-night stand for a hit of dopamine because it's the only thing that will get me through this rough patch at work. I'll take care of my family. My wife won't know. No one will care. And I'll get my family to this next stage. In his eyes, having an affair was rationalized until it blew up in his face at 30 years. So when I guided both of them through that understanding, he wept. A man who had almost no emotions for most of his life wept. And that was the first time his wife actually comforted him during our sessions and touched him. She saw him as a human being and understood the suffering he'd felt. It didn't undo his betrayals, but it did help her lose the contempt and start to see him as a human again. And then he started to feel everything he had ever made her feel. And he lost his resistance and said, I have starved you for 30 years and I had no idea. He could see the loyalty and faithfulness she had given to him all that time. After that, they were able to actually connect, and she could actually see him as a human, and he could see her as a loyal companion. They built secure attachment, and a year later, they got to celebrate their 31-year wedding anniversary, which to them was year one. It was all over again. It was such a new relationship.
They started over.
Full intimacy, full joy, full connection, better than they had ever been. Neither one of them had ever felt something like that before. So, yes, it's always possible if people are willing.
It takes an extraordinary partner to forgive those betrayals.
Massive, massive. She was such a kind human being. But she also understood his suffering and that he was trying, in his way, trying to be a kind human being too.
See, that's the thing to understand sometimes. Rather than just seeing it, your husband betrayed you. He's a bastard. He needs to go.
Yeah.
Or I need to hate him or whatever.
Yeah.
To see that maybe there's a reason he was doing that.
Yes. When we see a homeless...
It takes incredible insight and forgiveness.
Yes. When we see a homeless person on the street eating out of a garbage can, we say, that's disgusting. How could a human do that? That's gross. I couldn't eat that food. But when you... If you live that, if you talk to these humans who are living in this suffering, to them... Yes, it might be gross, but it's the only thing they have. And when you're starving... you will reach for things that would disgust anybody else because it's all you have. It's the sadness and the tragedy of the human being who is enduring unbelievable suffering, whether it's biochemical suffering for 50 years of a human life, where he has been starved and alone and doesn't think anyone will ever love him, so he endures dopamine binges and justifies it, or a person who is reduced to eating what anyone else has thrown away. It's human suffering. We have to be compassionate for both.
Are there people who grew up in, like, I hate to say perfectly, but perfectly adjusted homes with good parents, and they were loved unconditionally and all that? Are there people there that grow up like that?
There are people that grow up with secure attachment. I can't say perfect. I've got 5 kids myself. Number 6 is coming, and I do what I can to try to give them secure connection. There is no perfection.
What do they look like when they're in relationships as adults?
They don't put up with people treating them poorly, and they don't get angry about it. They just go, oh, that's weird. Thank you. And they just leave and go to the next person. They just move on because they know there's abundance. They can find people who will treat them correctly. And then they have respect for other people. They're expressive and explicit in conversation. They just go, you know, you look really frustrated today. Are you okay?
Really good communicators.
Really good communicators. Do you just need some time to cool off and relax? They don't assume it's their fault. They just assume you need something. And they just ask. If somebody passes away and their friend is suffering and sad, they don't go, oh, that's awkward. I don't want to get involved. I'll just wait till they talk to me. They go in there and say, look, it looks like you're suffering and you're my friend and I don't want to intrude. They give context. I don't want to intrude, but I don't want you to feel alone either. So what can I be doing for you right now? If it's leave you alone, I will. But if you need me here, I can do that too. In fact, here's 3 things I can do for you right now because you probably can't even think about it because you're so sad. What do you need from me and how can I help you? They get in there explicit and they're proactive and they're focused. They're not perfect. They still have mistakes. They have bad days. They make bad choices sometimes, but they always trend to the better because they have such clear communication and a lack of terror. The relationships are not fearful for them. They're not dangerous.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing to experience, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And people can build to that. Growing up in that, raised secure is great. Remade secure can have that too. But you have to have the right humans so you can have those connections with them. Your brain needs to learn through human experience. You got shifted through human experience. You have to shift back through human experience. Our brains are learning computers that only care about actual, factual, practical data. It doesn't care about hypotheticals. No matter how many books you read or experts you talk to, it's the human impact in your life that makes the difference.
There are people who grow up to be healthy, like adults, like you just described.
Absolutely.
Who don't necessarily come from perfect childhoods.
No. Oh, my gosh.
My ex-wife was one of them.
Yes. Right. You can grow up and be a secure human being who is at ease in your relationships and fulfilled, no longer afraid, at rest, asking questions and having people treat you properly so that you're not afraid anymore. That's the target. Every human can have that. Every human is built for that.
Yeah, humans are incredible, aren't they?
We are. We adapt no matter what. The attachment issues we have, they're adaptations. If 1,000 years ago, the Vikings, the Danes sail in, they burn your village to the ground. They grab you as a 5-year-old and drag you back to Denmark as a slave. Now you are not supposed to be securely attached to these people. You are supposed to be afraid that they're going to hurt you or betray you or abandon you. So you please them to try to get along and survive, or you push in and you're a lone wolf and a ruthless survivor and you stake your own claim in that world and you survive and then build the next generation who will be healthier than you are. That's what attachment issues are for. And in the West, the world has collapsed around us so much. The human race has been punched in the face over and over and over and over with so many issues and so much upheaval that we've never had time to stop and actually fix our family systems. They've got worse for 100 years. That's what we're living in right now. When I said Gen Z is growing up in ashes and rubble, that's what they're growing up in. The skills have been lost. Most parenting is just survival now. You're just surviving and getting your kids to 18 and launching them with no money, hoping they make it too. That's it. We have to build back into systems where humans are integrated correctly the way we're meant to be.
What fixes do you see that would help? I mean, like technology is part of our lives now.
It is.
And it's causing problems.
It is. It's also a tool. So like this is technology. Us having this show, this is technology. People watching this right now, they're gathering information.
And learning.
Most people stop at gathering information because they're afraid to take a step. You have to have skills and find one person, even just one human in your life, who would receive you well if you said, I want to live better. I want to live different. I'm going to be more explicit. If I'm afraid, I'm going to ask you questions. I want you to do the same for me. Can we make a pact that we will be transparent and honest and clear and communicate right? And through that, as we have the experiences, and I check in with you and I say, you look like you're mad at me today, but maybe you're not mad at me. Are you, or should I calm down? No, I'm mad at Steve over there. I'm not mad at you. Oh, so I'm okay? We're great. We're fantastic. If we weren't, I would tell you. Oh, good. I can relax. That doesn't just fix the stress. It actually creates trust between you because now you reached out for reassurance and they comforted you. And you asked something bluntly instead of assuming, so they can now trust you more as someone who asks. And the trust begins to grow. So you craft a secure relationship, which then allows each of you to become more secure. The relationship is the vehicle for the changing, the relationship itself. So human interaction with a trusted human, one, two, three people, completely overwrites your entire brain. It's amazing.
Hmm. What would you say about cultural differences, religious differences, racial differences in couples, and the success rate of that?
The research shows that if you have the same religion and you're actually practicing it daily and you actually are living it faithfully, both of you, your risk of divorce is likely less than 1%. We know this for a variety of reasons, sometimes because religious people won't get divorced. But if you're actually practicing that level of mindfulness and care and humility that religions teach, you have those values. You also have shared values. It probably has baked in long-term goals that you're trying to work toward. So if you have long-term goals that you're working toward as a couple that are explicit, long-term legacy goals that you're uniting around, if you're doing that, if you're running your marriage more like a business that's built to achieve those targets that you happen to get to enjoy each other along the way, that's a number two. Marriage is and was and always will be a business arrangement first that has romantic elements tagged to it. Always. And it needs to be. If you can have those united goals, it doesn't start to matter then what race you are, what color you are, what languages you speak, as long as you can build the vasopressin and oxytocin through shared goals, clear communication and intimacy that actually builds you together. If you can do that, great. Part of the problem is when you have language barriers or different customs, different traditions, you may not share those connections as much. You might have different definitions, different goals, different everything. That's what you have to unite around. When you can do that, those are the variables we track that really make success go up.
Marriage started out as kind of a business transaction.
It always has been.
And it still is, you think?
It still is. It needs to be. It has to be. My wife and I, we just had 17 years together. We had our 17-year wedding anniversary, and we run it like a business. On our anniversary, I took her out. We sat down. We did our year in review of how we've done toward our goals, how we felt toward each other, and then how we feel toward each other now and what our goals are looking like now and how we're going to progress toward our goals going forward and how a healthy, loving intimacy between us will facilitate those goals. It needs to be an intimate, connective experience, but it has to be for a purpose. It can't be get together and share good feelings till one of us dies. That's not the purpose of marriage. It's what are we crafting together? For some people, that's kids and a family and great grandkids and everything. For other people, it's building a nonprofit. For some people, it's building a library of information to help the world. It's changing the world. It's supporting a cause. It's all of those things sometimes, but you have to have a reason, and then you co-found it together, equal in human dignity and equal in value, and then you choose roles within that of what we will be doing to help achieve that mutual goal. That's what marriage has always been. It's what it still needs to be.
Super interesting. It seems the what people see marriage as being is now it's more of like the emotional excitement, the romantic aspects are so important now, whereas maybe 40, 50 years ago, yeah, marriage was just like, he'll work, I'll stick with him, yeah, we'll raise kids and live happily ever after.
Well, people don't have goals anymore. People are just surviving. So the feelings help them cope with daily survival. People don't look at legacy. Legacy is a forgotten word. People scoff at it. They say, oh, isn't that like what old kings used to talk about. People don't have legacy focus. They don't even have lifelong goals. If you ask someone what their goal is, it's to save $5,000 in their bank account for an emergency. That's their big goal. It's to get my kids to 18 and maybe someday they'll be happy. Their goals are so short-sighted, it is survival. When we remove just survival and we get someone to stability and sustainability, they start to dream big. And that's where the goals come back. Marriage is designed for long-term legacy focus. It's not the feelings of just raw survival getting through day to day.
Has life become just too stressful and difficult for most people?
Without our structured...
Survival becomes everything then.
It is. Without our structured hunter-gatherer tribe of family, expanded family, kith and kin networks, the other tribes around us that would have formed up to about 150 humans, Dunbar's number of how many people we can personally care about. If we don't have that structure, then yes, life is too stressful. We could live in a utopia and life would still fall apart because we don't have that structure. We need human bonds that are endurable and enduring and sustainable and intimate. They don't have to be perfect. They have to be predictable and intimate for safety. And then all of the other crap we deal with, everything else, the Vikings, the exploding volcanoes, the tigers that run through camp and eat part of our family, the disease, we can survive that because we have this. But if we don't have this, then suddenly everything else is death and terrifying. It's, I have to talk to the person at the counter about my sandwich because they put pickles and I asked for no pickles. No, I can't. They'll yell at me and I'll be ostracized and I can't handle that stress, so I'll just not eat today. It's, oh, my views didn't get up on that video. I failed and everyone is watching me fail. Everything becomes life and death because we don't have a tribe. You're not meant to live alone. Humans aren't. We can't. We die.
Last question, Adam. Are you optimistic about the future of marriage and relationships?
I wouldn't have six kids if I wasn't optimistic. I'm so optimistic. I think that marriage is going to make a resurgence as a business. And I think Gen Z is going to see that, or Gen Alpha. They're going to see it and say, you know, if only we had a system where we could agree to share goals and work together no matter what, and it was set up with clear arrangements of how to communicate and honor each other, and if we had consent-based intimacy baked right into it, and we always checked in with each other and had meetings about how it was going, that would be smart. What would we call it? I think they're going to reinvent marriage. I think that some of them will obviously spiral off. Maybe half of them will spiral off into just feelings and drugs of every type, not just substances, but relationships and electronic. And they are. But I think some of them will say, this is not appealing. What else is there? And I think people like you and I and everyone watching this, what we're doing is building a library of information so that future generations can look back and say, huh, there's already a concept for this. I just have to follow the concept and build, update it for us. Let's do this. Let's do this intentionally. I think future generations will uncover the mysteries of the past and reinvent everything that served our ancestors for generations. That's what I believe. It'll be dark for a while for some people. Some people will collapse into depression and into drugs. But I really think the future belongs to the people who bring back and update marriage, family, honesty, truth, and growth, and goals, and legacy. I think when we can do that together as humans, I think the future is brighter than it's ever been.
I love your positivity.
Thank you.
Adam Lane Smith, thank you so much for coming back again and enlightening us all about relationships and love. And until next time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.